I've framed this presentation around what is going to be a pretty significant change in our educational structure in Antigua and Barbuda, and that is providing access to secondary education for every student coming up from primary. This is part of what has been called the Caribbeanized Millennium Development Goals, because for primary education, we've pretty much feel that we have covered, provided universal primary education. But secondary education has still remained relatively inaccessible to some students based on common entrance examinations. Where we are, just around at the bend of the chain in the chain of islands, not too hot in our winter. We know which we're having now. Winter nights get as cold as maybe 19 degrees Celsius or so. But so that's where we are. Country profile. There are two main islands, Antigua and Barbuda. Antigua is the bigger of the two islands. Population from the 2011 census has been estimated around 90,000, but only about 1,500 people live on Barbuda. In 2005-06, the Caribbean Development Bank did country poverty assessments of these islands, and it found that poverty levels in Antigua and Barbuda were about 18.3%, and that is among some of the lowest in the Caribbean. Although, since the economic crisis of 2008 or so, we do believe that that has increased. And Gini coefficient, which is a measure of the richest and poorest, if you like, so it can go between 0 and 1. It has been put at about 0.48, which is relatively high by Caribbean standards. It's usually, for developed countries, around 0.3 or so. And that means, practically in Antigua, that the richest 20% of the people consume about more than 50% of the expenditure. The poorest 20%, only 5% of country expenditures. Poverty levels, though, for amongst children is higher than what it is for the population. So poverty is a characteristic of children. 36%, even though children 0 to 14 only make up 27% of the population. And the report also went out on to report that amongst 5 to 14-year-olds, girls, 25% of them were poor, with 9% of them being vulnerable to being poor. And for boys, 28% were poor, with 14% being vulnerable to being poor. Our birth rates and so on show that more boys are born than girls. And the report said of education and poverty, where the household head had at least primary school education, the odds of the household being poor was reduced by 91% compared to household heads who possessed no education. With respect to secondary and tertiary education, the odds were 41% and 26% respectively. So in this presentation, I will look at, for some reason, some of this has gone off the screen, but that's what I'm hoping to look at in this presentation. And I did have some questions, and I will hope to at least address some of these questions, not necessarily in the order that I have them there. But one of the things about universal secondary education is, while we're giving everybody front-end access to education, how do we ensure that they come out with qualifications at the end. Policy rhetoric. This is based on a policy document, 1988 policy document from the Ministry of Education, that its educational policy is first that the child be socialized as a human being, and only secondly as an economic unit of production. That's what we see. However, the reality of that is that the education system still remains very much academically oriented. Our country motto, from our coat of arms, each endeavoring, all achieving, and we will see how that has had some implications, raised issues, especially when we now talk about giving everybody access to education, because there's a feeling of you haven't worked for it, so why are you getting it? Some recent progress in education. All students get textbooks free. It's a loan system. They give it back after the year. That has been in place for almost 20 years now. School meals, though, has only been introduced in the last 5 years or so. And so far, it's only at primary level, and it's not in every primary school. It's only in public primary schools. And the children do pay, or the parents pay. They pay a dollar, but they're and one easy dollar. But if there has been an assessment that they can't afford it, then they get it free. And the government also provides free uniforms to students. It used to be two. It has, since the economic crisis, gone down to one per year for students, whether they're in public or private schools. And one of the recent phenomena, if you like, when they started the school uniform program, which again only started about maybe 5 years ago, it used to be mostly public school, government school students who would, parents who would access that. But since the economic crisis, private school parents have been going for that too, and I think that was more than the government had planned for, which is part of the reason as well why they've reduced it to one uniform per child. But these are big steps as far as I'm concerned in the government's acceptance that poverty is an issue in educational achievement, in providing these social safety nets for children. And some of that came in response as well to the country poverty assessment, where children were, poverty was particularly an issue for children. Some other things that have been happening, ICT for students in primary schools, if either the school gets computers or community access centers are built on school compounds so that the children as well have access to that, or a school bus goes around and the children use that. The phasing out of the junior secondary level, the tops of primary schools, and which was a step for universal secondary education. Recently, there has been a one laptop per teacher provision for trying to get teachers to integrate ICT more into their teaching and learning. The education system, so we have the junior secondary level there, but that has been phased out. And one of the things I really wanted to highlight in this slide is the dependence of provision on private education. Preschools, only about 1% of preschools government-owned. The preschool sector is largely private. Primary education, about half the children in primary school are in private schools. Some of this is church-based, but they are fee-paying schools. They do have access to the school. They do also get the school's textbooks. They don't get school meals. They get uniforms as well. But parents pay. secondary schools. There are about as many private secondary schools as government secondary schools, but about 75% of the children in secondary schools are in government secondary schools. And that top of primary school has been taken out. Children who fail common entrance would normally go on to junior secondary level, and then if they go, since compulsory education is between 5 and 16, they would either retake an exam after 3 years trying to get into secondary school, or they would simply leave the education system. In 2010-11, there were 19,000 children approximately in compulsory education, that is primary and secondary schools, which is about 22% of the population, and 49% of them were females. In primary education, about 11,000, 48% female. And remember that I said there are more boys born than girls. But in secondary, about 8,000 children, students, and 52% of them are females. And if we look specifically at secondary school, forms 1 to 5, we see while some boys are making it into secondary school, they're certainly not making it out at fifth. They're being lost somewhere prior to that. The issues and the Ministry of Education's focus, these are some of the areas that the ministry is presently focusing on, especially with universal secondary education. The highlighted ones are what I hope to address. Access and quality. The ministry has been focused on access at different levels. Early childhood, it wants to increase its provision at early childhood because it is convinced that that is making a difference. From research evidence, USC at secondary, everybody is supposed to get into secondary education, and they're hoping by attending to those areas that they can increase the number of persons getting into tertiary education, which by their estimates is less than 10%. Now, in that last slide, there is nothing there about primary education per se, because the government is pretty happy, if you like, with at least access to primary education. But what it wants to look at now is shoring up access at primary by attending to quality of primary education. So that at primary, the concern has been with the quality of provision. In 2007, they introduced assessments at the end of grades 2 and 4. These assessments are formative, and they have remained largely formative. And those seem to have helped. We haven't done any research to show so. But they seem to have helped at least the number of children reaching a certain minimum at the end of primary school. There has been a focus on reading. Schools now have specialist reading teachers, and there's a pull-out program where students would go to the teacher to help with their reading. But reading, interactive pedagogies, listening to students, and building communities of practice are parts of the work we've been doing as well with the center, with Mike and Molly from the center here, on how we can raise students' achievements so that by the time they get to secondary school, there is a certain minimum standard that they meet. And this we see as an opportunity for universal secondary education. One of the things we've been doing on the project is shared reading, shared learning. And this is what one child said. This is usually a younger child and an older child, a grade 3 child, a grade 5 child. They read to each other. Ideally, the grade 5 child should be helping the grade 3 child. Sometimes we've found that it has been working the other way around. And they read, they read to each other. And one grade 5 child said about shared reading, the best thing for me of shared reading is that I got a chance to read. I got a chance to read. And before, I never got a chance to read because we had a lot of work to do in the classroom. And we only got a little bit of time. Now we do a whole period and to read, and that was very fun, and it helped me with my reading. And one of the things that child said made me think about is the fact that one of the things we want by the end of primary school is for students to be able to read. But sometimes in the busyness of doing school, that gets lost, of completing the curriculum, giving children time to develop a love for reading. So that this has created that aspect. So even with the pull-out program, the focus is still on learning to read, whereas this has developed for them a love for reading. So that one of the things, as I've mentioned, about access at the primary level that the government has been concerned about and that the project has helped with so far is not just the students' presence in school, but access to the content of the curriculum. So that access is not just about, I am here, but creating enabling learning environments so that students can be able to match what is being taught to their previous experiences and so can access the education that's on offer. But there are issues to do with access. Early childhood education, there are some, even though the government wants to increase its provision, but some parts of society are resistant to this because they're feeling that government is going into a private sector area. They're going to be competing with private sector providers of early childhood education. So that has met some opposition. There is the issue about education. Is it a right or is it a privilege? And even with tertiary education, there are questions about relevancy as well. That because it has remained largely academic, the whole education system has remained largely academic in orientation. There is this World Bank report, for example, talked about students finishing school with still not the basic skills, some soft skills, teamwork and so on, but other skills, reading, writing, and the three R's, basically, so that there are questions about the relevancy of how we have structured education in Antigua and Barbuda. And then to the questions about who is going to benefit from this anyway. Because for preschools, when children start compulsory education at primary, what we've found is that about 75% of them have been to preschool. But those who are going into a private school, about almost all of them have had preschool experience, whereas only about 50% of those going into a government school have had preschool experience. In going from primary to secondary, about 81% of them, universal secondary education will be instituted next year. So as yet, only 81% of students based on common entrance are getting across into secondary school based on the results of that. And again, it's largely private school students. Only 73% of government school students are making it across. And this actually has increased because 6-7 years ago, it was the 81% was closer to 60%, made up again largely of private school students. And at least making it out of secondary into tertiary or some or post-tertiary institutions, only about 39% of students go on. What I'm not able to say is government-private distribution there, but it's about 41% female, 37% males. But I say this too with some caution because some parents send their children overseas, and this only accounts for those children who stay in Antigua and Barbuda. And this is another way too of looking at what the education system is doing in terms of access. Now, for access, you also want to be able, you want students to be able to move through that system, move from not only from primary into secondary and so on. You also want them to be able to move from kindergarten to grade one, etc. And in secondary to move from form one to form two and so on. What I am hoping that that highlights is that primary, okay, this is a cross-sectional look. All things being equal, you're expecting a relatively flattish line going across. You're having something going up, which is suggesting that there's probably repetition at the close to the end of primary. But by the time you're getting into secondary, things start to go haywire. And in, rather than the line goes up, again showing marked repetition at those areas, and then drops off, showing that some students are just not making it out in the expected way of secondary school, and especially so for boys. But it's also true for girls as well. So that secondary education is full of risk factors for students. And just wanting to highlight that that is pretty much, if you chose a year, that's pretty much how it looks. Now what I wanted to, I don't expect you to be reading all of this, but what I wanted to highlight was that for those years, and while we're still employing common entrance as a filter for secondary, boys in government schools, the yellow areas, they have been, even sometimes marginally, but they have consistently been the largest group sitting the exams. They're also the worst performing group. And prior to 2009, less than half of them made it into secondary school. The areas in the lighter color compared with girls, so these are boys in private schools, the area lighter color, and I wanted to highlight that those boys, relatively speaking, are doing well in private schools. When you compare to girls in government schools, those boys have done better than girls in government schools in all of those years. There hasn't been a year yet where they haven't done better than girls in government schools. So that the issues here do have to do, their gender, yes, but it's very much cross-cut by class. But this is one of the things that universal secondary education is doing. from 2003-04 to 2011-12, the number of boys at least getting into secondary school has been increasing. That's good. We need them, though, to make it out of secondary school in the expected ways. And there is a concern that, okay, so now they've gotten in, and so what? How do we open up the secondary school curriculum so that these boys do have access? And remember, in particular, it's a particular kind of boy we're looking at here. It's likely to be the boy who used to fail from a government school. And the fact that he's coming from a government school is likely to be indicative of some level of poverty. TVET, that is Technical and Vocational Education, has been proposed as a particular option for them. But the problem with that is that it has been stigmatized because in the educational structure, it's offered as what you do when you can't do anything else. And so some students tend not to want to choose it in school, but they will drop out of school to do it and go to a youth skills or that sort of thing, or work in a mechanic shop to do that sort of thing. So that it needs to be one of the things we do battle with is how to get this curriculum to be responsive to the needs of who's coming in, who is supposed to be catering for. Now, quality issues. Some of the quality issues have had to do with teacher recruitment. Prior to 2009, to be a primary school teacher, you needed 4 CXCs, including English. CXCs are, if you like, GCSEs. Since 2009, it has been 5 CXCs plus mathematics. Teachers then spent 2 years in the classroom before being sent to teacher training, and that was a sort of insurance for the government because they wanted to make sure that a teacher would stay in teaching before they actually invested in sending them to teacher training. But what teacher trainers have said is that they spend a lot of time in the 2 years that the teachers are there on content rather than methodologies. There is, too, an issue because even after when they're finished from teacher training and have been successful and so on, in recent times it has taken 2 to 3 years for them to be upgraded, and that has been demotivating for teachers. And at secondary level, the teachers there do tend to be more qualified, but there's also they tend to be younger and a higher turnover rate because they move on to something else. But in the work with Mike and Molly and Penny and Marianne, in terms of one of the ways we're trying to address issues of teacher quality is get teachers themselves to share and talk to each other. And it might seem that this must be happening, it's a small place, but I think sometimes it's in a small place where things just don't work as you think they would. Sometimes people know each other too well for that to happen. But we have been working with teachers at primary level in particular to get them to talk to each other. And these have been the teachers' perspectives because they have really taken this and, well, the group of teachers we've been working with and ran with it. Because we've introduced them to the idea of building communities of practice. And they see it as a way to learn from each other in particular. So that schools really become a place of learning and less a place of teaching sometimes. And they also see communities of practice as the missing piece that bridges the gap between all the enriching experiences they get from teacher training, and then they go back to this isolated classroom. So that we've had teachers talking across schools, and we're also trying to get teachers to talk within schools. And it has been easier to get the teachers to talk across schools, maybe because they don't know each other as well, but this has been the within school aspect that is we're working on. Some of the things that the ideas that I have gotten in this 3-week period here have been about teacher leadership and the need for introducing the idea of distributed leadership to principals. Now, teacher leadership, the teachers that we've been working with want to see changes in the education system because they do recognize that it isn't working efficiently as it should. And one of the ways we see this of doing this is by them leading development work within their schools, across schools. That if they see something that needs to be done in a particular school, a particular child who isn't responding to what is being taught, perhaps they can work with that child, see what will work, write about it, share it with other teachers, get ideas on how they can make that work for them. So that the community of practice aspect is one, I think, of the lasting ideas that this project, and one of the more powerful ideas that the project has been doing so far, and I'm hoping that it will it continues. And I do see that if we do get it, and we're building, and it does need a lot of work from me, but I can see it as being a potentially powerful tool because it's changing the system from within, starting with teachers themselves, rather than a top-down Ministry of Education approach. And I think that that has potential. But some of the challenges so far has been with leaders and leadership. And leaders I'm talking to include Ministry of Education, not only leaders at school, not only school principals. Because some of the ideas of teacher leadership are actually relatively revolutionary because it is change at a point where you're not expecting change, if you like. Space and time for some of this to happen, and that this needs to go forward in terms of a shared vision. But it is a robust education system. These, I think, have been significant changes. Government's recognition of poverty, the removal of that primary secondary filter, and enabling research in schools and being prepared to ask about what the research says, and in some very small instances, but hoping to improve, actually act on some of what that research says. So that policies do not have to be just somebody's armchair musings on how we should go forward. And in the words of some more words from our national anthem, we commit ourselves to building a true nation, brave and free, so that that has meaning. And so these are what I think are some of the ways forward for education in Antigua and Barbuda. Thank you.